Welcome along to another episode of the Sports Marketing Podcast, powered by Fanbase. I'm Chris Sampson, and I'm joined by Tom Bonnet today. Tom and I only met when I joined Saints back in 2021, but we quickly struck up a strong friendship and worked really well together. We actually already followed each other on Twitter, as I'd spotted the trajectory of his career, which is mainly what we walk through in today's podcast. He's gone from journalism to Surrey Scorchers to Saints, and is now Senior Marketing Manager at City Football Leadership Institute, the City Football Group's education partnership with Branded. Let's get into it. Enjoy.
Tom Bonnet, hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. This is strange.
This is strange. We're in person recording for the first time, well, for me, in ages, since Michael and I, who was on the last podcast, plug, we used to record at Hampden together. This is not quite Hampden. It is. This is your spare room.
Yeah, my house, my office. It's weird, isn't it? Because we talk every single day, and then you put a microphone in front of us, and now we're all like,
we're giddy
and awkward.
Yeah, it'll be fine. I've got loads of questions.
Okay.
We're going to talk through a bit about basically your career.
Yeah.
Which feels weird, given that you're so young as well compared to me.
And also, you've seen half of it. You and I have half of it, yeah.
But yeah, we'll just start off because I think, like, well, from my perspective, and I'll probably record a separate intro, which you almost made me record now, but I think your career is quite unique as well.
Yeah.
Like, because of where you are now and where you started. And I think that's really, it'll probably resonate with quite a lot of people as well, which is why I wanted to get you on the podcast. And also, you've been pestering me for about 3 years to come on the podcast.
Of course.
Can we start off with, like, education then? Because, I don't know, I look at, obviously, I went to university, but you went to college and then didn't go to uni.
Yeah.
Was it ever in your thinking that you wanted to go to uni, or was it all about, like, okay, college and then, like, that next step?
Uni was always an option, but I didn't really ever think it was the right move for me. I did my GCSEs and A-levels like the majority of people do. And following that, I did a one-year journalism diploma because at that point, I was just fully focused on getting into journalism. And a journalist at the Portsmouth News had, like, put me onto that program and said, like, you should look at this because, to cut a long story short, if you do a journalism degree, you get at the NCTJ diploma as part of that. But this is like a one-year streamlined course that would save you 3 years and all of the fees that come with going to university. So it made sense for me to do that at the time. So as soon as I was aware that that course was available to me, that's what I did. And then from there, I did work experience alongside that diploma and ended up getting a job at the end of it with one of those, which was Solent News, which I'm sure we'll come on to. But yeah, so for me, uni was always a backup option, but I was really focused on just getting into the industry as quickly as possible.
Do you think that, not that it hampered you initially, but, like, I don't know, I always feel like I went to uni just because I wanted to go to uni, and I felt like I had to go to uni as well. Obviously, you didn't really feel like that. Do you think it, like, impacted you in any way at all, or do you think that that college course and then the little bit of work experience alongside the college course set you up in, like, such a good way to actually, like, move into proper career?
There was always a little bit of fear in case I was making the wrong decision, because I think there's certainly a stigma, or there was until about 5 or 6 years ago, that university was the route to take, no matter which industry you were going in. Like, it makes sense if you're going into healthcare, law degrees, those sorts of things. Like, you obviously need a degree to do those things, but journalism's a lot more relative. So I didn't think it was the right move for me, but then you've obviously got parents who have the traditional views of maybe that is the right route to take. So it took some persuading to kind of show them that this could work for me. As soon as I was on the diploma, I knew it was the right move because I was getting so much work experience. When I was at Highbury College, I was doing work experience with the Portsmouth News in their sports desk. I was doing weekly work experience with the Surrey Scorchers basketball team, work experience with Solent News. And the last two that I've just mentioned there, I ended up working for full time following the end of the diploma. So looking back, it made sense and it worked out, but there was definitely a bit of nervousness going into it.
So that news kind of reporter stuff then, like, what skills do you think you picked up from that you've still taken forward in the rest of your career so far?
Well, I think in journalism, it's a race to the finish in terms of accuracy, the the speed that you have to report is so important, because in agency reporting, when you're covering high profile news stories, you're competing against other companies. You know, for me, Solent News would be kind of brought in by the Mail Online or the Sun or the Telegraph to go and cover a particular court case, for example. The BBC are in the room and PA are in the room, so there's competition. So you had to be really accurate, really precise, really organized, and all of those skills transferred into marketing in the future.
Yeah.
So it definitely, it really helped. But for me, before, my whole career was focused on getting into sports journalism in particular, and this role was more hard news. So it was different to what I thought I would be going into. But it was a great experience, and I definitely think it set me up for the rest of my career, because I think when you're under so much pressure, especially in a court environment, you cannot get the journalism wrong. You cannot mess up. And therefore, going into marketing, it's obviously not as stressful as that sort of experience, but it's the transferable skills.
You don't want to get anything wrong in that sort of marketing sense either. Like, you put the wrong info on, I don't know, a landing page or a flyer or anything like that, and either thousands of people see it or it doesn't get used at all. And it's like, you always want to get it right.
Yeah, it's the attention to detail.
Yeah.
And also, when you're working in sports, you've got a fan base who often know the answers themselves. So you get picked up on stuff a lot more. So there is the pressure, but certainly good experience from journalism that I've transferred across.
So you mentioned sports journalism then. Like, you always wanted to do that, but did you get more experience in that, or was it more like kind of hard news stuff that you did?
Well, I mean, during the actual diploma that I did, it was all sports focused. And then probably around February or March, it's in an academic year, so about halfway through the program that I was doing, I got my first taste of work experience with Solent News. And that was suddenly, you're going from covering Portsmouth Football Club or Surrey Scorchers to you're going with a journalist to do a death knock because someone's mum or sister has died in a tragic accident or something like that. It's a real wake-up call of like, oh my goodness, this is like real life news. And then the entirety of that Solent News experience was hard news, so I moved away from the sports side entirely, but it actually helped me to build up the skills of being like a full, you know, qualified journalist. All the things I've been learning in the classroom, putting it into the practical side. So there was kind of an 18-month hiatus of not doing sports and just focusing on the news. And at the time, Solent News and my colleagues covered like Novichok, which was the Salisbury poisonings and things like that, some very high profile cases. Which, you know, I was 19 when I got that job. So you grow up very quickly and you're suddenly thrown into a really cutthroat environment. And I think those skills then were great to bring back to sports, because suddenly you're not in that high pressure environment in that respect. It's a different way. But yeah, I think I look back at that time as it was necessary for my development, because then I've been told a few times throughout my career, I act older than I am. And I think that 18 months is the reason why, because you're dealing with people's lives and really, really tragic stories at times.
So many like big things. And like you said, so young as well. Like,
yeah.
Even when you just said like death knock there, I was like, that's such a horrible way to put it. But like the way that it, like, yeah, actually having to go and do that.
Yeah.
You can't muck around with that.
You can't describe the feeling either, because you feel guilty because you're knocking on someone's door. And, you know, one of the examples I can think of is someone who was doing a parachute jump and the parachute didn't open.
Oh my God.
And they obviously tragically passed away. You go and knock on their mum and dad's door and say, do you want to tell the story of your son to the world and tell everyone what he was really like, and kind of pay respect to him in that way? And naturally, most people will shut the door on your face and tell you to go away in different terminology in most cases. But I think that experience really gives you perspective as well. And I don't think I would have done that job for the rest of my career, because it was like that. It was very negative at times, not because of the people, but because of the stories that you cover.
Yeah. From that sort of news and journalism to marketing then, was marketing always on your mind, or was it something you just sort of fell into a little bit?
No, marketing I fell into, because when I'd done work experience previously, for example, with the Surrey Scorchers, it was very much a social media and match reporting side of it. So when I ended up being offered the job as the fan engagement coordinator, I think was the official title, I was going into it thinking I'm going to run the social media and I'll do the ticketing and other things on the side, but the focus will be growing the account and growing the brand, because British basketball isn't one of the major sports in the UK. Most people probably couldn't even name three or four British basketball teams. So for me, it was like, okay, I'm going into a market where we have to win fans. And so to do that is social media. That was the quickest way. So the marketing side actually came afterwards when I realized, actually, yeah, we've got to use these channels to sell tickets. That was the main point of view at Scorchers until COVID hit. So there wasn't really a time going into that. I was like, yeah, I really want to get into marketing. Then when I moved into it, I was like, oh, this is really interesting. This actually is a lot more appropriate for me in the way I like to work than potentially the journalism was. I preferred being in a team than being a third party reporting on the team or reporting on the story. So yeah, it became quite a natural fit in that place in Surrey.
Obviously it was 2019, I think, when you started Surrey Scorchers.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That little period before COVID then, what did the day-to-day look like? What were the main things that you were doing?
Well, yeah, it was quite a unique role because not only was I covering Surrey Scorchers in basketball, I was covering Surrey Storm in netball as well.
Yeah.
So there was two professional teams and, you know, there were people there to support me, but I was kind of the main port of call from a marketing standpoint. So you'd be going down to the training sessions, capturing content to obviously engage the fans, but also you'd be working on ticketing week to week, as you do in other sports. You'd be looking at season ticket campaigns. You'd be looking at all the analytics of how we can grow the team. But it's on a much smaller scale to what probably a lot of people who will be listening are accustomed to with some of the bigger teams.
Mm-hmm.
The capacity for the arena they played in was 900 people. So it's a completely different kettle of fish. So
does that change now?
No. They still play in a university campus at University of Surrey. And, you know, my biggest pet peeve when I was there is I wanted to expand, but obviously you need budget and you need investors, and that wasn't there at the time. But yeah, so the week to week would be getting the social media right was a big part of my strategy. At the time, I didn't even think of it as a strategy, but looking back, it obviously was.
You just did it.
Yeah, but then it was, okay, ticket sales are here. Let's engage with local schools. Let's get fans in. And my perspective of it was basketball isn't competing with football or rugby or cricket. It's competing with the cinema or bowling. It's a family orientated event. So that was the focus. And right before COVID hit, we got, I think, back-to-back sellouts for the first time with the basketball team in particular. And then COVID hit and I did a whole season with no fans. And that was the last time that I saw them all.
Yeah. And then you had, even still during COVID, like quite a lot of access to players. Like I always remember, I think we must have first talked about it when I first joined Saints, and like you did quite a lot with the players during that point, obviously under restrictions. Like how did you manage that, and what was some of the stuff that you were getting up to?
I mean, the season itself was great. I loved it because for me, particularly with the basketball team, I was a fan of the team. So I would look up to the players, and the players that I was with were players that I'd watched growing up. So for me, it was like, I get all the access to these guys, but they were super accommodating. And I think they really welcomed that side because they hadn't really had much of it before, the social media access and stuff like that. So during COVID, I really made an effort to try and connect the players to the fans. So at one point when restrictions were lifted to an extent, we went to a local park and met up with a fan. That was like a surprise, and did a content piece there. During one of the first lockdowns, I made some top trumps of the players to send, and fans could print them off at home and use them, that sort of thing. It was just trying to have innovative ways that weren't revenue driven to kind of engage with the fans so that they would come back when the time came. The players were great, and then when we got into the season, it just became a natural reporting on the team and the performance and things like that.
Did you find that, was it different with fans there versus no fans there?
Yeah, it was. I mean, you had to generate an atmosphere. So the five or six of us who would be in the arena with the team would cheer when they scored, for example. We'd play loud music and things like that. But I definitely felt, because of obviously everything that was going on, the team were bogged down in the COVID side. And obviously it was affecting a lot of people in different ways. Some of the players and the coach like lost family members and things like that. So it was really raw. And at the time, there wasn't a vaccine. So there was definitely a fear of us traveling around the country. Like we had to do COVID tests every single week. There were a couple of times where the team were struck down with COVID. So it was just a roller coaster, and you just had to roll with the punches. And there were times where we thought we were close to getting fans back, but it didn't quite happen before I'd moved on. So yeah, very strange, because I did 5 months with fans. It felt a lot longer than that, but then I did 12 months with no fans, which is just crazy.
I feel like time works differently when you look back on it now in that COVID period.
It's just a wild time, but I can't speak highly enough of my experience there. And it was so good for my career, and it was great personally. I look back at it with great memories. I'm still friends with many of the players to the day. So, yeah, I really enjoyed my time working in basketball in particular.
Basketball, like, obviously, like, you always slag me about the Scottish Scottish basketball, but, like, basketball in the UK, I think, even now, looks very different to what it was then and obviously before as well. What is your thoughts on, like, way forward for UK clubs and basketball?
Well, the biggest problem basketball has is making it a sustainable business model. So driving revenue so that you can break even was always the challenge for Scorchers in particular. Not to get into the politics too much, but an American investor, 777, who I think are buying Everton or in the process of buying Everton, bought the league. Mm. And now they're kind of funding the London Lions, which is, I guess, their flagship team, their Manchester City or whatever you want to describe it, of the basketball league. And now they're funding them to try and race to get into European competition, into the equivalent of the Football Champions League, but in basketball. Problem is, it's not a sustainable business model because they're not driving revenue. They're not, they're spending millions of pounds. So they're either going to continue to spend millions of pounds with no plan of breaking even, or is eventually going to, the buck's going to stop somewhere and the funding's going to be pulled. So the game is still in the same position. So really the clubs need to be building sustainably, gradually building the fan base and finding different commercial revenue streams to bring in the income, the revenue, and building the fan bases to justify being a professional league. So it's in an interesting place. And don't get me wrong, like, I went to a London Lions game a couple of weeks ago. The atmosphere is great. 3,000 or 4,000 people were there. Great atmosphere. But the success they're having doesn't necessarily reflect the entire league. It feels like they've spent loads of money and got a great team, but the rest of the league is still lagging behind. Yeah. So it's in a really interesting space. So I'd love to see a situation where the other 9 clubs really start to grow commercially and they can start to compete and make it a more even playing field, but also just for the future of the game, that all the teams are sustainable and are going to be there in the long term. We're not just going to have a team pop up here, pop up there, and then disappear 5 years later.
It's interesting, that approach that you mentioned from the investors, in terms of, like, yeah, they've sort of bought the league, but they're kind of focusing on just one club and they're sort of putting all those effort into that one club as well. Like, I find that it sort of feels like they're sprinting before they're walking.
Yeah, I think their approach, I don't know this for certain, is to bankroll one team, they get to a certain level and hope that they'll bring the other teams up with them.
Yeah.
But it's not, that's not how basketball works in this country. They don't have a TV deal that generates a huge amount of income. So, you know, it's not even comparable to some of the other sports in the country. Like, each of the teams is their own little ecosystem.
Yeah.
And there's only 10 of them. So it's not like they've got a team in every city in the country, like in the EFL, for example. So, you know, you've got great opportunity to raise the profile of the game. It's a very popular sport to play at the grassroots level.
Yeah.
It doesn't transfer across to the professional game in this country as of yet. And I'm hoping that will continue to change.
Yeah. I think one of the things, obviously, when people say basketball, you just immediately go NBA.
Yeah.
Like, was it difficult having the NBA there as this, like, huge thing that influences so much when you're sort of on a smaller scale, when you're working in it as well?
Yeah, it's really difficult because a lot of people in the UK who are basketball fans will watch the NBA.
Mm.
And there was a lot of people on social media who would be called, like, the UK Chicago Bulls fan group, mm-hmm. or the Milwaukee Bucks. And some of them would attend a British basketball game and they'd enjoy it, but I didn't think there was the same fandom. And naturally, you know, I understand it. It's an international game, the NBA. You're never going to compete with the NBA.
Yeah.
But there was definitely an element of people not really understanding the British game or how good the quality of the basketball actually was. And I think the league have done a good job of trying to change the narrative a little bit. And a couple of former NBA players now play in the British league, which I think is helping to grow its profile. But that was always a challenge. But look, I think if the British League can even have 1/100th of the success of the NBA, then they're doing a good job.
What was the best thing you did at Scorchers when you were there?
I think the thing that I'm the most proud of is I doubled its social media reach organically, because at the time, this shows my level of basic knowledge about marketing at the time, they were doing paid ads and I shut them off. I said, why are we wasting our money doing paid ads? Because I knew none the wiser. Grew it organically, did really well, and that transferred into ticket sales. And the fact that we had 4 or 5 sellouts was the most we'd ever had in one season just before COVID struck, showed how quickly we were growing. the trajectory was really good. So I, and now they have sellouts regularly, and it's great to see. And obviously the people that came in after me, the teams after me, have done a brilliant job of really growing the franchise. I'm so happy that they're doing that. But it's nice to feel like I played a part in growing that team. So yeah, it's a nice legacy to leave behind, I feel.
Is it weird, like, when you work for a club, and obviously you've had this twice now, so I'll maybe ask you about it, Saints, in a second as well, but like, is it weird when you leave a club and you sort of have such an affiliation to it, and like, you really, really enjoyed your time there, and then you look back and like, there's new people working on it or different people working on it? Like, how do you feel about that? Is it like a strange feeling?
Yeah, it is, because people will do things differently to how you do it. I think at the start, especially when I left Surrey, I was very nitpicking and judgmental of it. I was like, okay, they're doing this, I wouldn't have done that. But you have to understand, you're a custodian to the team.
Yeah.
And the next person is the same. And I'm sure the team before me, both at Scorchers and at Saints, would have seen stuff that we were doing and thought, why is he doing that?
You know?
And yeah, it's definitely hard to let go. But as soon as you do, it's quite nice just to let go and just accept that someone else is taking it on a journey now.
I think it's nice in that way, because obviously where I was at Skyscanner, like, it's not as public, if that makes sense. Like, the stuff that I was doing wasn't as like high profile as maybe a sport or like football, obviously, when it comes to Saints. So like, I've not really had that where I look back and I'm like, oh, why are they doing that? Or like, what's that? And, like,
yeah,
it's quite nice.
Because there's an element of fandom to it as well. Like, I still care about the Scorchers and Saints and like check their results and check the team. So I'm still in that circle.
Still get dragged along to St Mary's every now and again.
Well, yeah, and when I go, they lose. So yeah, it's business as usual for me. But yeah, it is strange. It takes a while to get used to it once you've left.
The Sports Marketing Podcast is now powered by Fanbase. Fanbase is now one of the fastest growing sports technologies in the UK and Europe. They work with leagues, teams, and now athletes to provide an off-the-shelf platform to run your back office teams. Their first product, Fanbase Commerce, allows any team to set up their box office and mobile ticketing, VIP hospitality and subscriptions at the same time, whilst unifying your first party data and giving sports organisations and athletes the control of that data. Fanbase will be announcing new products with us throughout the course of this podcast series, so stay tuned to hear what's next. It's great to have them powering the pod, and you can listen back to the episode that featured founders Ali and Michael if you missed it when it was released.
Saints then.
We've got so much to discuss.
We've got so much to discuss about Saints. How did it, like, where did you see the job? I think it was on LinkedIn, wasn't it, that you spotted the job?
Yeah, I kind of felt when I was, my time at Scorchers was coming to an end, I wanted another challenge, because I felt at the time I couldn't take it any further than where I was. I didn't want to stand still. So I started actively looking for other positions, and I saw the job as a marketing exec come up at Saints, applied, and about half an hour later, my manager-to-be called me and kind of checked on who I said I was and asked me a few questions, and a couple of interviews later, and suddenly you've gone from basketball to being in the Premier League, which is a bit of a wild few months.
And you were thrown in at the deep end of a busy first day on the job, were you not?
Yeah, I mean, the first week was a kit shoot for a kit launch, which was pretty crazy. And shout out to Georgia, she didn't tell me that you didn't have to wear a suit in the first week for that. So I rocked up with some work shoes on and had to empty a fridge, like a big fridge from the concourses, because we were, the shoot we were filming was Ralph locking Oriol Romeu in a fridge. So I was there in my suit, emptying the fridge of all the drinks and stuff like that. But it was a really cool welcome to the Premier League sort of experience, because I got a fist bump from Ralph. I took Oriol Romeu around the pitch from one side of a shoot to the other, being up close to James Ward-Prowse for the first time. And I was just like, wow, this is so real all of a sudden, because, you know, basketball, as much as I love the guys, they're not on, you know, from a, you know, a celebrity standpoint, on the level of the Premier League players. So that was a really wow moment. And from there, it kind of just continued and never really looked back after that.
Yeah. And then I came along and everything changed. I can't even remember the first time that we, like, even spoke to each other.
No, me neither.
Or worked on anything. But I think we pretty quickly discovered that we worked really well together.
Yeah.
And, like, we were, like, constantly just bouncing, like, ideas off of each other about stuff that we either wanted to do or, I don't know, critiquing other things that we didn't want to do. But
yeah, I've always said the marketing team in that first season at Southampton was absolute gold dust for me, because I was just getting nuggets of information off all sorts of people. And you were a great example where I felt we obviously got on as on a friendship level, and I think a lot of people did in that team.
Yeah.
But I would be asking you, because you were introducing me to paid social for the first time from like a professional point of view. You're an expert on that. I'm not. You taught me a lot about Google Analytics I'd never really had to use before. So I felt it was invaluable to me to spend time with people who could give me more information on it. And then from that, we would say, okay, this piece of information is really interesting. Can we apply that to a certain campaign we're running? And it went from there. So yeah. That's the memories I look back. But yeah, I cannot remember the first time we spoke either.
No, it's weird. Maybe we should just make them like a story up or something. Right? But...
yeah, I mean, I just remember that you sat on your own for the first 2 months.
Well, the desk
kind of behind us, so you were in the corner, but you'd always be facing the opposite direction.
The desk situation was weird when I first joined, because obviously, like, we're still, what was it, 2021?
Yes,
we were still sort
of, we were just coming
like,
out of COVID, yeah. Really. Yeah.
And, like, offices were just sort of going back to being people in them at that point. And then we had another lockdown. As well,
like that
Christmas. So
yeah, I think I remember the first 2 months I joined, I was mostly working at home. And then I remember the team said to me a few months later that I was like really quiet at the start because I'd been working on my own during COVID at Scorches, and I go into this open plan office with loads of people who already know each other, and I was like, okay, this is different. And then as soon as I found my voice again, I didn't shut up.
You didn't shut up. I think you already said it, but like the biggest thing that stood out for me was like your. Like desire to want to take in as much as possible, and like you said, like the team was set up to do that as well. Like obviously Jack is my manager and was my manager then, and he's been there almost 10 years now, which is crazy, but even at that point he'd been there like 7 years 8 years, so like him being there for so long and having that all that Saints experience like built up. Like Tom Rose was your like head, well not he wasn't your head originally, was it? It was Charlie.
Yeah,
and then it became Tom, and then obviously Sarah was sort of leading up the team from that top, and it was like it was people that you could learn from as well, and people that wanted to do really good stuff and really interesting stuff and stuff that we all thought would work and stuff that did work as well. I think it was like it was such a good team. Obviously, it's changed a lot. If anybody's listening, I'm not saying it's a bad team now, but like. Yeah, definitely. Like it was such. It helped me to go into that environment as well, like because everybody was so welcoming.
Yeah.
But also, everybody got on really well, and it sort of gelled really quickly as a team as well.
It's rare to go into a team where the people at the top are really encouraging trying new things and innovation. And Saints had a reputation, I definitely think, before COVID, of being that team that would stand out from the crowd and would do wacky social media initiatives and things like that. And I think that resonated with the team. I also liked that all of the management in our team would sit at the same bank of desks as we did.
Yeah.
So there was a period of time where you'd have the director, Sarah, at one end, and then you'd have all the marketing managers and heads of departments, and then you'd get down to the execs. But we'd all be together and we'd all talk to each other all the time. Mm-hmm. So it felt like ideas were just bouncing around constantly, which I think that's the value of having everyone in the office, isn't it? Having that balance of being hybrid working, the 2 or 3 days we'd go in, we'd all be there ready to talk to each other, meetings, ideas. And that just brought loads of cool things to the table that we were trying and were working.
You got to own like a business area, as we called them at Saints, like really quickly after joining in football development. Talk me through that. Like obviously we're probably talking in riddles for people who aren't listening, but like football development, explain what that is and then talk about like how you sort of went about it.
Yeah, so a lot of football clubs naturally will have grassroots coaching, soccer schools, summer camps, those sorts of things. And my role when I went in was to support my manager with retail. So obviously the kits and things like that. But then the football development side got moved across from the club's charity arm in the foundation over to the commercial side when I joined. So my boss, Georgia, was brilliant because she gave me full autonomy basically over that business area. And look, soccer schools existed before I joined the business and have continued to be successful afterwards. But we definitely enhanced its performance. And it was the first time that I was using data to drive decision making. And I think where Southampton is a one club city, there were villages and towns around Southampton that they were doing soccer schools in, but there wasn't much competition from other clubs. So we could start doing more marketing in those places to drive more soccer schools and people to come and attend those in the summer holidays and school holidays. So it's a small business area in the grand scheme of the football club, but all the practical skills that I learned working on that, I've now been able to apply to bigger business areas and into the different positions I've been in. So it was invaluable to me, gave me a great opportunity to showcase what I can do and learning on the job. And I look back at it as a really good time because I felt like for that entire year, every time we'd get some results in, we'd be looking at green on the screen. Mm. We'd be hitting new records and increasing the targets because we were performing so well. So it was great for me because it gave me the confidence to say, actually, the marketing that I'm doing is getting good results and showing that I belong at a club of this size.
Yeah, definitely. And then obviously performance in that, a few changes in the team, and you made the step up sort of ticketing and memberships. Few more eyes on that than football development, a bit more responsibility as well. What was the way that you looked at it in terms of the strategy for getting more fans to come to St Mary's?
Well, I think I just continued the work that other people were doing in the respect that it was clear, not to get into too much detail, that Saints needed to increase its fan base size. So similar strategy, I suppose, to football development, where we're trying to reach new towns and areas kind of on the outskirts of Southampton, applying the same thing with ticketing is, okay, we've got a very loyal set of supporters here who are going to be here every single week, but we've got a 30,000-seater stadium and there's some pockets here that we need to fill. How are we going to fill those seats? And it was an element of trial and error. It happened to be during the season that we got relegated, which made it even more difficult because fan sentiment was really low. So yeah, one place we could get results was to bring in new fans who maybe didn't think Premier League football was accessible from a pricing standpoint, just based on reputation of other clubs, perhaps. And we saw some really good results that season. Despite being relegated, the stadium was full the majority of Premier League games, which was really encouraging. So I definitely think despite the challenges that were against us, we still had a good season. And I think it was great for me because, like you said, it allowed me to take on a bigger business area that affected the business more from a revenue standpoint. And I'd like to think that I did a good job. And I think I really enjoyed it looking back. And I'm glad that I was able to do it.
You mentioned last season and relegation. Obviously, it was really tough, like when you look back on it now, but what did you learn from it? Like, did you manage to take like any positives from it at all, despite how negative it was overall?
Well, it just showed sadly, there are a couple of negatives of working in sports, and that is one of them. It's deeply frustrating when the team, and I'm talking about the marketing team here in particular, were performing very well across the board, but ultimately all of your work is then affected by the 11 players on the football pitch, and you can't control those things. So I think it was more of a mental mindset shift of, okay, I'm obviously invested in the team's results, but I can't control that. So you let go of that and just react to whatever's in front of you. I look back at relegation naturally, looking at the aftermath of it. So the redundancies that followed and the team that was there completely changed, and which is a real shame. But also, if you look at, not to drop many names here, but if you look at all of the people that were in that team and have moved into different roles, they're in amazing positions, which showed how good the team actually was we had at Southampton at the time. So I look back at it as thinking, I'm just really lucky that despite relegation, I was part of a really good team and lots of good people that I still speak to now. And I think we bonded over that relegation, despite how difficult it was. And without the culture that was there and the people, it would have been a lot more difficult.
Yeah, I think it definitely was difficult. But I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of like the team that we had and the culture that we had. It helped. Like it didn't solve everything, but it definitely helped, and it went a long way to make you still want to come to work like the next day, despite a defeat at the weekend, for example.
Yeah, it was definitely a case of there'd still be smiles and laughs in the office. And I know a Saints fan probably might not like to hear that necessarily. They're probably thinking, well, you guys should stop laughing and focus on doing your job, right? But in that culture, I think we knew for quite a while that we were going to get relegated. So let's try and continue to find the quick wins we can get and the points of difference from a marketing standpoint. And we still try to be innovative, but there's only so much innovation you can do when you're counting down the games until you get relegated. So the culture side, I'm very grateful that we were part of a really good team and everyone was very close. Like you say, it made that process easier.
What was your favourite thing that you did at Saints?
It's a good question. I don't really have a favourite thing I did at Saints, to be honest.
It's disappointing.
I look back at the football development phase, doing the soccer schools marketing as a really positive thing. I'm glad that I was a very, very small cog in some really cool kit launches, which is always a good experience for anyone working in football, being across that sort of commercial campaign. The ticketing side, I don't think is as sexy per se as like a kit launch. So
yeah,
I think they were successful. And obviously I'm glad the fans, as they mostly do, come back season after season and they continue to do so. But I'm glad that we were able to fill the stadium even during difficult points for the team on the pitch. I think that's the bit that can go unnoticed sometimes, because as a fan, you know how frustrating it is when your team isn't winning. You do lose the eagerness to go to games and you think, why am I bothering? I'm paying a lot of money to support the team. But despite that, we still have people coming to the game every single week. We have a full stadium, and there's not much more you can do from a ticketing standpoint than to bring the fans. They're there to support the team. It's then over to the team to deliver and create the atmosphere, isn't it, with a good performance. So
yeah,
those are the things I look back at as moments that I thought were really good for me.
You mentioned ticketing maybe not being as sexy as like a kit launch, and I think that's really interesting, because the way that I look at it is, when you think about Premier League, I think people automatically think all the stadiums are sold out and packed like every single week. And I think one of the things that I've always said to some people is that St Mary's and Southampton is quite rare in that respect, that we still did have to do, and we still have to do, a lot of work to fill that stadium for every single match. And I think that's, it's obviously really different if you compare it to like the top, the big six in the Premier League. They don't have to do anything. They've probably got waiting lists for like general admission tickets. But like, I don't know. I think it's one of the biggest things that people can take away if they're at a club, or if they're at a club like even, sorry, Scorchers at different sports, like having that routine and having that plan of what you're going to do to try and sell as many tickets as possible. I feel like looking, again, from the outside looking in at other clubs or other sports, not many have that. And yeah, I think that's a big thing to take away, probably.
Yeah, the strategy is so important, because you've got the core fans who are going to be there no matter what. And you have, obviously have to protect those and keep incentivizing for them to come back and make sure the sentiment is high. But then you've got that middle group of people who will attend 1 to 5 games per season, who suddenly don't want to attend when the team is not performing very well. It's a harder sell. And then you've got to still get new fans, because, I mean, Saints was a great example. It is an aging fan base. You obviously have to continue to have the flow of young fans coming in for the first time in a digital age where you can just support any team you want in the world, because you've got the access to the team. You can go and support Man City. You can support Liverpool. And also, from the research, even at Saints, showed that a lot more kids now are supporting players rather than teams, which is interesting. It's like an NBA or NFL approach. You follow your favourite player rather than the team. So suddenly there are so many different variables that affect the fan base. And with Southampton is a great example, because if the team is struggling, young fans probably aren't going to be as interested as attending games, because you've got other teams on the TV who are doing well every single week. So there's so many different challenges. So having a strategy, not just for that season and for that week even of filling the stadium, but for 3 to 5 years time, how are you going to have the conveyor belt of fans regardless of how the team is performing? That's always like the most difficult thing. I think Saints had a good strategy for that.
Yeah, definitely. I think as well, when you look at, obviously you were still there when we started the Championship season as well, and how that season ticket campaign and that summer went, where, yes, things were a little bit cheaper, but it was almost like a new dawn for fans as well. Like, and as you said, I think all football clubs have an aging fan base, but we managed to decrease the average age of the season ticket holders that we had and bring in much more younger fans because of that pricing structure, but also because it was something that they wanted to hook onto for this season. It was a little bit different as well. Like, I don't know, you look at a positive rather than a negative of being relegated. Like, it's a new league, it's new teams you're going to play, it's relentless nature of the Championship, like it's constant. But yeah, I think it was interesting the way that summer went, because it was sort of like everything that we were talking about and everything that we wanted to do came to fruition almost. But it was sort of like not as, like, we obviously aimed to do it, but it just felt like it happened naturally.
Yeah.
And as well,
we were also entering the unknown at the time, because I think the club had become an established Premier League team and planned to be so for a long time. one bad season and you're in the championship, and suddenly you've gone from a team fighting to stay up every year to being the bookies' favourites to get promoted. So the fans, I think, got on board with the idea of we're going to be the best team in this league. And I mean, Leicester and Leeds this season, and Ipswich have proven that, you know, the standard is really high.
Yeah.
They're winning loads of games, which I think it, as a fan, you obviously want to be in the best league, but ultimately you want to see a team win, don't you? Regardless of what league you're playing in. So it was just changing that messaging completely. And I think that really resonated with the young fans, because they'd gone from seeing the team win 5 or 6 games per season at home to winning the majority of games, which is so rare for a team like Saints who are in the Premier League trying to push to get into the top 10. It's a different ball game suddenly.
Yeah. Yeah, the season in numbers campaign last season was, we had to change it completely because there were fans that hadn't seen any home wins.
Yeah.
And it's like, we probably shouldn't talk about that. We probably should
reflect on the season and trying to incentivize people to buy a season ticket when they haven't seen any good results.
Yeah. Isn't it? So you went from, like, obviously that negative season at Saints, but we've gone into this season, like, you're not at Saints anymore.
Yep.
You're at City Football Leadership Institute. And I just had to read that out.
It's awful.
I keep forgetting. But I think that's one of the things, and obviously we'll get onto that in a second, but for anyone that doesn't know, explain what it is and explain what your role is there.
Sure. So I'm going to call it CFLI because it's easy to say, but City Football Leadership Institute, or CFLI, is a partnership through a company called BrandEd, which is short for brand education, and CFG, City Football Group. And to cut a long story short, the company BrandEd want to, I guess, reinvent the wheel for education. So rather than necessarily going to university or doing a diploma to get into an industry, you can go and get first-hand experience and learning from the people who do the job already in their particular industry. So examples of the partnerships they have is they've got Condé Nast Fashion School, which is partnered with Vogue. They've got the School of the New York Times, which is partnered with the New York Times. Sotheby's Art Institute, which is partnered with Sotheby's. And then with us in 2022, CFLI was formed and partnered with CFG. So the masterclasses and the experiences that you can do there, you go and learn from the people not only leading in the industry and other businesses, but also they bring in faculty from Manchester City and from CFG clubs. So you can learn and network from the very best people in the industry. So it's a really different approach to getting into sport. And I think from my journey, it resonated with me perfectly because I took a really strange route or unique route into the industry. And I think if this was available to me 5 or 6 years ago, I might have jumped to that opportunity myself. Mm. So there's a lot of people competing for very limited places in sport. So where's the extra 1 or 2% advantage you can gain? This is a great example. So as soon as the opportunity became available, I applied, went through the process, and naturally very, very happy to have got the role. And for the first time in my career, go from a senior exec role into a managerial position, which is a really good step for me. So it felt like the right time and the right fit for me.
I think where you were talking there about it potentially being that place that people want to go to gain a bit more experience or to gain that little bit more insight into what goes on in the industry, that definitely resonates. Like over the years, obviously, had some listeners, had some people that have followed me, especially on like social media platforms, and it's students that are looking to kind of make that break into the sporting industry. And I think there's not that many places to go, if I'm being honest, in terms of, yeah, you've got like UCFB like down here, but it's like, yeah, where else do you really go other than uni almost to sort of get a little bit more insight, get a little bit more like time almost to then think about, okay, is sport actually what I want to go into, while you're building up a bit of like a educational kind of background as well. So yeah, I think it's really interesting in terms of you're given it is that place that maybe a potential sport industry candidate can go to get a little bit more insight and to get a little bit more of like a peek behind the curtain.
Yeah, almost. It's an enclosed industry. I think when you're in it, it's easy to talk about being in sport, but getting into the industry is the hardest step.
Oh, so difficult.
And I think that
took me like 13 years.
Yeah, there you go. And for me, I think that the good part about it is we have a summer residential where you can go inside the world of Man City. It's called Next Gen, which is for 14 to 17 year olds. So for them, they can have a taster of all the different roles that are available in football in particular and in sports, and you can start to see what might be the right fit for you in the future. And then you can tailor your future career plans towards those particular roles. And then we've got loads of professional programs for people who, like you said, 18 to 25, who have maybe finished a degree or didn't go to uni and can move into those and learn from the experts. And also higher up as well, we've got high performance leadership masterclasses for managers and business leaders in sport who want to continue to develop. You know, there's something for everybody. And I think whether you're at the start of your journey into sport or you're in it and you want that next level of development, then this is the place to go. And I think that the point of difference is there are so many different credentials and courses you can do online about sports and sports marketing, whatever it might be. But how many can you say are taught by people who are doing the job, not only in sport now, but at the very, very highest levels? So, for example, growing a global brand is a masterclass we've got coming up. The head of marketing at Man City is one of the lecturers. Like, you get the networking experience and you get them as a connection, but you also get the knowledge of the people who are doing it today, not just someone who did it 10, 15 years ago and are now a lecturer, for example. It's practical knowledge you can apply today. So I think it's a great product and I think it's a great concept that I think would be very popular.
One of the things you said before we started recording actually was around like just trying to build awareness at the moment. Is that the main aim? Because it, like you said, it's still relatively new. It's trying to break into that industry and compete with some of those other courses that you have mentioned as well, and show it as like a viable alternative to here's something else you maybe want to get involved in and have a look at. Like, what, how are you going about building that awareness at the moment?
Yeah, there's definitely two sides to it. The first side, of course, is getting bums on seats and people attending these programs. I mean, this is the third year now that we've run the Next Gen summer program for teenagers, and we've already doubled the amount of registrations as last year. So that shows that it's a successful product. The difficult part is the professional side, because it's a very saturated market. There's a lot of educational providers, CPD, there's loads of options you can take. So it's trying to find our point of difference in that market. And that doesn't just mean from a marketing standpoint, from the product side as well. It's trying to find out, okay, what do people want to be doing? Do they want to be learning in person? Do they want online? Do they want a bit of both? These are all things that we're still trying to learn, which is a really interesting challenge. And to be part of a team where not only am I doing the marketing, but I can actually contribute from a program standpoint, because I've worked in sport. I have a better understanding, arguably, from other people of what you're looking for as part of your development. I think that's a really cool thing to be part of, that I can help a team to build the products. The other side of it, from the program standpoint, is also the brand awareness. Like you say, we're starting from the beginning. And I think the interesting part is, I think the link between CFG and education isn't as straightforward as maybe we thought it might be from day one. So therefore you have to build that story of, okay, who we are, what we do, and the advantages that you're going to have from studying with us, which is really cool, because I think when people find out about the product, they really like the concept, and I think that people really back it to be successful, and I think it will be successful. But starting a company in 2022, when many other institutions have been around for a lot longer, is quite difficult, and you've got to win people over to come and study with you rather than with someone else. And I think it will continue to develop, and I think will grow quickly. And I'm excited to see and be part of that process.
What's next?
Well, I mean, for me, I definitely see myself being part of this product and this process for quite a long time. It's my first venture into marketing management, which I think is just a different world to what you're used to with the exec role, where you're doing the practical skills every day, but now it's the strategy point of view. And it's really interesting because we have a real startup mentality, which is really good from a marketing standpoint, because you can be quite creative with the route you want to take. Yeah.
Just try stuff.
Exactly. That it is trial and error at the moment, but educated, and obviously using analytics and data to support that. But that's where I see myself being. And from there, I haven't really thought too much further than that. I try not to look too far forward in my career. I just hope that CFLI can be successful, and I hope that my marketing can do it justice for the product, because I think the product's really good.
I think it's exciting. I think it's like you, I don't know, it does feel like a really good fit in terms of like you going in there, and also it being something that, I don't know, like you said, it's maybe like a couple of years old now, but it still feels quite new in the industry as well. I'm still trying to like break in, so I think it's exciting.
Yeah, it is new, and it comes with its own set of challenges being new, because it's easy to lean on an established brand. But even CFG is still relatively new.
I was going to say that, so. Yeah. Like, I think, obviously, I don't know, some people have negative connotations of, like multi-club ownership and, like, those groups that are sort of becoming even more bigger in football and have much more of an influence. But, like, I don't know, I think this is a really good positive out of that as well, and it's them trying to use what they have and really push other people forward as well. Like, I think, like, that, yeah, it's just a really exciting thing that has come off the back of them setting up the group of clubs. Yeah.
I think the interesting part for us is CFG, people know who they are, but they're not as front-facing as Manchester City or the clubs themselves. So if you said that you're partnered with Man City, that's different to saying you're partnered with CFG. So it's quite an interesting dynamic, but I think CFG have really good intentions behind the program. And I think that they approached Branded, the company that I work for, to start the partnership. So I think that it works both ways. And we've got a really, really good team of educators at Branded that are pushing it forward, and they are for all of the brands in the different industries. So it's a cool concept and cool to join that group of very elite companies that are doing the education side. So I think it's just going to really reform the way education works for people who are looking to get into those respective industries.
Yeah, nice. I'll put, obviously, links in the notes if anybody wants to check stuff out. Give it a plug.
Thank you.
That's all right. We've reached the final three, so we've talked loads about, like, your career path so far. What's one piece of advice that you'd give, like, drilling down into one thing?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not going to be the first time anyone's heard this advice, but work experience is the most important thing if you're trying to get into sports, in my opinion. A good example I can give is when I was doing my diploma in journalism, I emailed the Surrey Scorchers just to do work experience. And I checked the emails recently and I got rejected 4 different times because naturally they probably just thought he's a fan, he wants to be involved. So I started attending the matches and writing match reports and sending them to the local newspaper, the Surrey Advertiser, which was a weekly newspaper who weren't covering the basketball. All of a sudden, Scorchers were seeing match reports written by me in the newspaper. And then when I emailed again for the 5th time, they're like, yeah, come in, write the match reports. So it just goes to show that the practical experience is going to open doors. And then I did work experience with Solent News. I ended up working for them. And I did work experience with Surrey Scorchers. Ended up working for them as well. So my first 2 roles in my professional career were as a result of work experience and already having those connections. And I do believe that if you message people on LinkedIn, for example, and you find the clubs local to you or teams local to you that you're passionate about, or you want to report on, most teams will accept the help and will encourage and welcome the support. Maybe not the clubs in the Premier League, for example, because they've obviously got massive teams of people doing those roles. But lower down the pyramid, there's so many opportunities to get experience. And I think that opens doors for then for you to move up into the bigger roles. And what better example to give than myself going from the British Basketball League to the Premier League in one move. And, you know, looking back at it, I'm obviously very proud of that move. And people in basketball were super proud of me and happy for me. But all of the same practical skills that I learned from basketball, I could bring to a club of that size. So it just goes to show that the day-by-day knowledge you can get from being in a business is the best thing you can do, whether you're studying and doing it on the weekends or volunteering, even when you're a professional, you'd want to move into sports, and that's a good place to start.
I feel like you mentioned, obviously, you might not get that practical, maybe longer period working experience if you messaged a Premier League club or if you messaged somebody in there. But like, if you message somebody that works at a Premier League club, like, they probably will reply to you. They might even get you in for like a quick tour and just be like,
yeah,
like, here's how things work, like, behind the scenes. Like, I think, I don't know, not saying that that's not happened to us, but like, it's definitely people that have messaged us, I remember at Saints, and it's like, you try and help them.
Yeah,
you might not be able to help them in a practical way immediately, but you give them what advice that you possibly can. So yeah, like, my LinkedIn is always open. If anybody wants to message me, I'm sure yours is as well.
Some people are going to ignore you, but there's going to be one or two that reply.
Yeah, 100%. And I think
if you find those gems that are going to reply, then that you're already one step ahead.
Yeah, nice. Who's catching your eye from a marketing perspective right now? Could be like a club, league.
Well, I mean, I attended the International Sports Convention this week, and I listened to a really good panel about how music can be used to shape sports industry and fandom. And Chris and I have talked about this before. Wolves are so impressive with the way that they have diversified their commercial revenue streams, and they've ventured into the music industry with their own label. So from that point of view, basically the guy who was on the panel from Wolves this week that I heard from, I cannot remember his name, basically said that they had to find a point of difference between the other mid-table Premier League clubs to drive commercial sponsors. And therefore, having a music label means not only are you tapping into the sport industry, but you're also entering the music industry as well. That's genius. Like, what a great way to bring culture, like pop culture and sports together. And they were bringing in local artists to be part of the label that the fans really resonated with. And you're seeing that a lot. For example, I can't remember the name of Arsenal's song they now play at the start of games, but an Arsenal fan wrote that. They've only been playing that at the games for a couple of years. And it's all of a sudden you bring the local community and sports together, and music's a great way of doing that. So
they just did a retail range of like a local artist.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. So I think Wolves really impressed me from that, and from social media, I'm going to keep saying it, and I will keep saying it. Bristol City are the best in the EFL, arguably even the top four leagues in England with social media. And I'm not only saying that because I know the social media manager, Ryan Morgan, who I did work experience with Surrey Scorchers. That goes full circle. But their branding is great. Their messaging is great. And for a team that, no offence to Bristol City fans, if you're listening, have been mid-table championship for years and haven't really had too much to shout about on the pitch from that respect, they seem to get it right all the time. And I always look at them enviously, but also very jealous, but also very impressed with the way that they do their social media. It always tells the fan story. They put the fans first of everything they do. And it's really impressive.
I agree.
They're great. I think
they are great. And I think like the thing that jumps out, and we've obviously like messaged about it before, like just the imagery of stuff.
Yeah.
I think Jordan, who's at Bristol City now, used to be at Hearts as well. So like obviously there's always a Scottish link that I can bring back
always.
On, but yeah, definitely. Final question then, who should I be speaking to next on the podcast? Somebody that's not already been on.
It's a great question. I don't know if he's been on. Has Dan Simonite been on here before?
No.
I think he's great. I first came across Dan, I think you did at the same time, when he was doing social media and marketing for York City, and they released new kits that he'd been had a part of, you know, that whole process and the branding for it. It was amazing. And I think since then, I think he's freelancing now, but he's done stuff at Arsenal and all sorts of different places.
World Cup as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he's really good. And I think he's a great example of how you can bring social media and marketing into a brand story. I don't know Dan personally. I've spoken to him a couple of times on Twitter, but he always impresses me with the stuff he does. And I think it would be great to hear more about his career and his story.
Yeah, nice. Now that I've sort of like branched out into trying to get more people on than maybe just Scotland. No offence, Scotland. But I'll give Dan a shout, definitely. See if he's keen.
Nice one.
Thanks, Tom.
No worries.
I think that went well.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
Good.